This is Gene with the BBC World News for Thursday, August 20, 2026. At least 15 killed in Kyiv as Ukraine grapples with air defense shortages. At least 15 people have been killed in the latest Russian strikes targeting the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv's mayor said, as Ukraine continues to face a shortage of air defense missiles. Blocks of flats and warehouses were struck across the city overnight, the State Emergency Service of Ukraine said, while a children's hospital and school were also damaged. Speaking to BBC News at a wrecked apartment block in Kyiv, Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said Ukraine needed ammunition, anti-missile systems. We need support from our partners. Kyiv relies on Western allies for the supplies, and President Volodymyr Zelensky said that as long as Ukraine does not have enough anti-ballistics, Russia will not seriously think about peace. He added, the interceptors for the Patriots have not yet been replaced, and they are needed every day. Additional missile saves the lives of our people. An update released by the Ukrainian Air Force on Thursday morning implied that none of the Russian ballistic missiles used overnight were intercepted. Ukraine has relied on American supplies of Patriot interceptor missiles to combat Russian ballistic missiles, but the U.S. has used much of its stockpile during the war with Iran. The Russian Defense Ministry said it used air, land, and sea-based weapons to target military facilities and warehouses. The latest strikes on Kyiv began around midnight local time as air raid sirens sounded across the city, followed by the impact of Russian missiles. The strikes cut power in thousands of properties, plunging parts of the Kyiv region into darkness. A day of mourning is to be observed on Friday. At a local school in the Solomyansky district, the windows were knocked out and its playing fields were left covered in debris. A nearby storeroom was destroyed, exposing the basement. The BBC was told it was a laundry and boiler house supplying heat to the surrounding apartment blocks. Ukraine's deputy intelligence chief told the BBC this was the kind of attack Russia was planning ahead of the winter in order to make life difficult. Anastasia Kovtun's flat was in a 9-story building that was hit in the attack. The primary school teacher said she felt like her head was going to blow when she heard the explosions in her area from the shelter. It's so frightening to realize it's your house. You never think you're going to be next, she told the BBC. Valeria Bondaruk moved to Kyiv after her home in southern Ukraine was bombed, believing it would be safer for her and her daughter. Now she has been driven from her home for the second time during the war. She told the BBC she feared for her 13-year-old daughter's future and was considering leaving Ukraine. Elsewhere in the broader Kyiv region, an attack in the Bovary and the Boryspil districts killed one man and wounded 7. One person was killed and 11 injured in the region of Donetsk, a local official said. In Russia, the defense ministry said that 726 Ukrainian drones had been shot down after being launched at various regions across the country. In recent weeks, both sides have carried out massive airstrikes, resulting in dozens of deaths. Ukraine has stepped up its attacks deep inside Russia and targeted the capital, Moscow, with a wave of 600 drones at the weekend. Two separate attacks on Russia this week killed at least 16 people, including one child. Despite the ongoing attacks and vulnerabilities on both sides, there has been little progress in diplomatic efforts to broker a ceasefire. Both sides accuse the other of targeting civilians. Russia first launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 and currently controls about one-fifth of Ukrainian territory, largely concentrated in the eastern border regions. Captured Ukrainian-born soldiers tell BBC why they fought for Russia. In western Ukraine, behind high walls and layers of locked gates, there is a camp full of men captured fighting for Russia. Many of those crouching in the shade around the edges of the prison yard were recruited from big cities like St. Petersburg and Yekaterinburg, not far-flung and poorer regions like at the start of the full-scale invasion. But not all prisoners are Russian. Amongst them are soldiers from Ukraine itself, the men who went to war with their own country. Interviewing prisoners of war is not straightforward. To be sure, they are not being coerced, first and foremost, and then to assess how openly they are speaking in the circumstances. But with no access to the military inside Russia, it is a chance to assess the dynamics of this war and explore what might motivate the men fighting it. That includes the Ukrainian-born soldiers on Russia's side. We gave everyone the right to refuse an interview and spoke to those who agreed far away from any guards and without cameras. As well as several formal interviews, I was able to talk to prisoners directly in Russian in several locations. Anton was 10 when his part of Ukraine's eastern Donbas region was taken over by forces loyal to Moscow. In 2022, when Vladimir Putin escalated to all-out war, he turned 18 and signed up to fight immediately for Russia. "I don't regret my choice. I went to defend my land," Anton insists, and tells me his friends volunteered too. Then you get the SMS messages, "dead, dead, dead." Other prisoners say the same, that all those who went to war with have been killed. They also say fewer people are volunteering to replace them, despite enormous sign-up fees, which suggests Putin's desire to avoid mass mobilization could soon be tested. When Ukraine captures its own citizens on the battlefield, they are put on trial for treason. But the men are then sent to POW camps along with Russians. Officially, Kyiv still sees them as a Ukrainian and treats Russia's control of their regions as temporary. But the reality on the ground is more complex. They're very pro-Russian, and their national identity is very blurred, is how Petro Yatsenko from Ukraine's coordination headquarters for POWs puts it. Anton certainly does not class himself as a traitor. "I consider myself Russian. A country means nothing. It's all about nationality. All my family are from Russia. All my roots are from there," he says. When we wonder about his Ukrainian surname, he brushes that off as irrelevant. An entire generation born in Ukraine has now grown up under occupation, with Russian schooling and media fully controlled by the Kremlin. Both have portrayed the authorities in Kyiv as Nazis and illegitimate for many years. Since the full-scale invasion, Even more territory has been subjected to the same. Anton has absorbed it all and now speaks almost entirely in Russian slogans. He calls Putin my president and thinks he should push to take the rest of the Donbas, even though hundreds of thousands have already been killed trying. It's a shame that people died, especially those who are innocent, Anton says. But war is war. It could have been ended, but no one wanted to do that. In the prison hospital, Artyom lies in a corner bed, his body full of shrapnel. He has only been fighting for 2 months. From Donetsk, like Anton, he also went to war willingly, not just for the cash. We have our own grudges, Artyom says, recalling how his region came under heavy fire in 2014 as Ukrainian forces tried to stop it, breaking away from Kyiv. But his military experience has left him bitter. His commander was bad, and he never got any of his 400,000 rubles, that is $5,000, sign-up fee. To add insult to Artyom's many injuries, the wounded Russian soldier in the bed opposite was paid five times as much. All the Ukrainian-born POWs we interviewed came from areas occupied since 2014, and almost all joined the Russian army voluntarily. But one man from Donetsk region told us he had been forced to fight. His eyes darted around as he talked, unsure of who he could trust. One official tally citing, quote, intelligence, suggests more than 50,000 Ukrainians have been conscripted against their will in occupied areas. Others put the figure far higher. This man told us that when the Russians invaded, his family had stayed, not through any political or national allegiance, but because Donetsk was their home. Now his only ambition was to get back to his wife and children, then avoid being returned to the front. I'm just going to hide, he confided. Beneath the hospital windows and newly whitewashed walls, there were rows of strawberries and cucumbers planted by the prisoners. Further on, the stench of varnish from an outhouse is overpowering. An official lifts a gold-colored plastic handle from a bag near the door. Guess what this is for, he challenges us, grinning. Inside, I do a double take. The men working are hammering together wooden coffins. I am told the last contract the prison got was for garden sheds. This one feels macabre. Across the courtyard, in another workshop, a handful of POWs are making artificial Christmas trees, gaudy baubles strung from their machines. Like the coffin makers, they tell me they'll use their wages to buy extra food and cigarettes. Sergei was born in the Ukrainian city of Luhansk, but says he is Russian like his parents, who moved to the Donbas when both countries were part of the Soviet Union. He joined the Russian army a decade ago to defend my homeland, but claims he will retire when he gets back, not return to the front. Quote, I've done my bit. Most will have no choice. Stacking plastic branches next to Sergei is a drug dealer who signed up, like many, exclusively to avoid a long jail term. For me, 15 years in prison was too much, Konstantin explains. I know it probably doesn't excuse me, but it's a fact. I'm 44 now. I would be 60, so no. But Vishniki, who are convict soldiers, have to survive to the end of the war to be released, and in the assault troops, the odds are not good. Three convicted murderers told us they had thought they could walk free after fighting for a year, only to have their contracts renewed automatically. When I ask about killing their fellow countrymen on the battlefield, Sergei calls the question provocative and does not want to answer. I see nothing good in any war, and it's a war like this, there can be nothing good a priori, Konstantin replies carefully. I'm not saying we're the same as Ukrainians, but we're close. We all have relatives there. This just isn't good. He still thinks his decision to fight was right. Neither he nor Sergei expect the war to end soon. Both believe Putin won't stop until he controls the whole Donbas. But everyone I know there has had enough, Konstantin says. I just want this to be over, as soon as possible. At lunchtime, the prisoners in Navy overalls file into the dining hall, with heads bowed and hands clasped behind their backs. As they eat soup and stew, a video called Myths About Crimea plays on a loop, demolishing Russia's claim to historic ownership of the peninsula that it stole from Ukraine in 2014. But no one pays the slightest attention. The re-education efforts feel half-hearted. For Kyiv, the real focus is on using these POWs as swaps to bring its own soldiers home. But when it comes to negotiating exchange lists, it turns out the men from the Donbas are a low priority for Russia. Only a dozen or so have been transferred this year, Konstantin complains. It seems like they don't want to exchange us. I think we will be the last to go. Harry and Meghan are experts in surprise, but why are they returning to the UK now? The past few years have been littered with surprises from the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. Harry and Meghan have become experts in shaking things up, making unexpected decisions, rocking the boat. Now add to that the news that they are returning to live in the UK. This has been a relatively sudden decision. I've now spoken to people who know the couple well, although there have been general discussions about the possibility of spending more time in the UK. The decision to move back was made recently. The family's visit to the UK in July was significant, as well as spending time with the King at Highgrove. Harry, Meghan, and their children, Prince Archie and Princess Lilibet, are said to have loved being with the family of Harry's mother, Diana, Princess of Wales. The children met their aunts, uncles, and cousins. The visit to Europe, which included time in Portugal, where they have a home, was described to me as such a great time for the family. It turned a possible move back to the UK into a firm decision. I am told that this move is not due to any problems in the US. It has been driven by the couple's desire to spend time in Europe, nearer Harry's family, and wanting to educate their children in the UK. Schools have been chosen for Archie and Lilibet. New terms for virtually all schools in England start by the second week of September. The Sussexes will need to settle in, so we can expect the family to be back in the UK within the next 10 days. The exact location has not been revealed, but they will not live in London. They are likely instead to be swapping a multi-million-dollar mansion in California for a slightly chillier prospect in the UK countryside. The Cotswolds and Northampton area, close to the Spencer family estate, Althorp, are rumored to be where they will settle. The king was not involved in the decision made by his son and daughter-in-law. This was a surprise to him and the wider royal family. The king was told on Sunday that Harry and Meghan would be moving back. He is said to welcome the chance to spend more time with the Sussex family privately. However, the move should not be seen as a precursor to a repaired relationship between Harry and his brother, the Prince of Wales. That relationship remains broken, with no clear sign of any reconciliation at all. There has been no official comment from the Prince and Princess of Wales. That's not surprising, as the sibling relationship was severely damaged. William has never been able to forgive what he sees as Harry's public airing of the family fallout through his memoir Spare and their interview with Oprah Winfrey. To put it mildly, Prince William is unlikely to welcome Harry and Meghan's move back to the UK and the distractions and sense of a rival team it will create. That said, they are not expected to return to royal duties. They remain private citizens and non-working royals. There is no interest from the royal household in creating a half-in, half-out arrangement for the Duke and Duchess. Any work they do here will not be linked to official royal duty. Meghan has been looking to expand her As Ever brand outside the U.S. Will we now have Meghan's As Ever jam sitting alongside the King's Dutchy organic products on supermarket shelves? It is really unclear what their security arrangements will be. In the U.S., the Sussexes have employed a private security team to protect them. There was no comment when I asked if that team would be moving to the U.K. with them. Nor was there any comment on getting official police protection in the UK, or on whether there had been any resolution to Harry's long-running dispute with the Home Office over his desire for official protection when in the UK. Last year, after losing a legal challenge over his security in the UK, Harry told the BBC, "I can't see a world in which I would bring my wife and children back to the UK at this point." Not at this moment, but they are expecting to be in the UK for what has been described to me as an extended period of time. Britain will be home for now. As with all things Harry and Meghan, how the public views this will depend on the often entrenched views people have of the Sussexes. They love them or hate them, that mood remains. But as one friend of the couple told me, "I'm just excited to have them here." Belgian car salesman becomes prince after royal parentage confirmed. Belgium's Prince Laurent has legally recognized 26-year-old former car salesman Clément van den Kerckhove as his son and heir. Van den Kerckhove, the result of a relationship between the royal and Belgian singer Wendy Van Wanten, was quietly brought into Prince Laurent's family at a town hall ceremony 6 months ago, although details have only just emerged. While he formally becomes a prince, he will not receive a royal allowance. The new prince has had several years to get used to the idea of having a royal father, and he said recently he was not yet sure he would begin using his father's name, Saxe Coburg. "I might want to do that, but I'm proud of the name Van den Kerckhove," he told Het Nieuwsblad. "If I were to sacrifice that family name, it would be a betrayal of everything my mother has done for me." He will not be part of Belgium's royal line of succession, unlike his half-sister, Princess Louise, and half-brothers, Prince Imeric and Prince Nicholas, nor will he take part in public royal activities. Vandenkerkova is already well known to Belgians, having been the focus of a Flemish TV documentary last September, in which he described how he got to know his father. His father had been in a relationship with Wendy Van Wanten, whose real name is Irish Vandenkerkova, before he went on to marry Princess Claire in 2003. During the VTM documentary, Clément described meeting the prince unexpectedly in a shopping center in 2013 without realizing who he was. It was only when he was 16 that his mother revealed his father's identity. 4 years later, he plucked up the courage to ring him up, and after several more calls, they met in person, and eventually Prince Laurent suggested that they take a DNA test. We went to the hospital together, and I remember him saying, "I'll go first, so you're feeling at ease," he told VTM. Then he received an email from the laboratory which told him of a 99.5% DNA match. Prince Laurent's DNA test is reminiscent of his father, former King Albert II, who had a test after a lengthy paternity battle. Albert admitted in 2020 that he had fathered a daughter during an affair and eventually recognized her as his own. Albert II abdicated as king of the Belgians in 2013 as the paternity issue became a royal scandal. Delphine Boel, a well-known artist, eventually won her court battle and gained the right to the title of princess, and now calls herself Delphine de Saxe-Coburg. Under changes to Belgian law in 2013, only a few members of the royal family are entitled to public allowances. King Philippe, his father King Albert II, Prince Laurent, and Princess Astrid. Giant whales move into Greenland waters as ice disappears. Sea ice has been disappearing from East Greenland, allowing giant whales to take advantage and move into previously inaccessible areas. That is the conclusion of a decades-long study that has recorded and filmed hundreds of the world's biggest whales, including humpbacks, minke, and fin whales, feeding in ice-free seas along the coast in summer. None of these marine mammals were historically found here, as they have been locked out of the coastal waters by ice. Now, as climate change warms the sea and melts that ice, they have adapted. Scientists describe the result as seasonal Arctic feeding frenzies, part of a major regime shift in the ocean environment along East Greenland. The change is dramatic. Ship-based surveys in the region did not record a single humpback whale sighting until 2006. In 2007, seven humpbacks were seen, and by 2024, there were 150 ship-based sightings of these giant whales. The first systematic aerial surveys of baleen whales, a group that includes fin, minke, and humpbacks off the East Greenland coast, were carried out by the researchers during the summers of 2015 and 2024. They combined that information with the tracks of 15 satellite-tagged whales and testimony from Inuit hunters, all building a picture of what the lead researcher, Paul Mads Peta Heidi Jurgensen, calls a major ecological regime shift. An estimated 4,000 humpback whales, 6,000 fin whales, and 6,000 minke whales visited the Greenland Sea in the summer of 2024. Professor Heidi Jurgensen from the Greenland Institute of Natural Resources told BBC News that the changes in the region were probably the most radical we can see anywhere in the subarctic. That shift is driven by rising sea temperatures and food availability. The whales appear to be feeding on fish that have moved into the warming waters of East Greenland. They estimated that the three whale species would consume at least 800,000 tons of fish and krill during a summer feeding season. It is not clear from this study whether the change reflects an overall increase in the populations of these whale species or just a redistribution from other areas. Other experts the BBC spoke to were concerned that the study suggested there was an influx of the animals from West Greenland. That is a sensitive issue in Greenland, a country where some whales are hunted. But the scientists said that their findings do suggest that these opportunistic baleen whales appear to be adapting and might even be benefiting from the change. Other Arctic species, however, are in trouble now, explained Professor Heidi Jurgensen. Animals, including narwhals and belugas, are sharing habitat with, or even being displaced by, these other whales. For some species, climate change is not necessarily a problem. It opens up new opportunities, said Professor Heidi Jurgensen, but other species are losing their habitat. The study is published in the journal Frontiers in Marine Science. Key Trump aide Natalie Harp suddenly in spotlight after years behind scenes. Few people in U.S. President Donald Trump's orbit have appeared as frequently by his side as Natalie Harp in recent years. One of Trump's longest-serving and most loyal aides, the 35-year-old is trusted with typing out his Truth Social posts among other top responsibilities. She was thrust again into the spotlight this week by Georgia Senator John Ossoff, a Democrat and frequent Trump foil, when he name-checked her during a speech that has since gone viral. Ossoff attacked Trump's travel with Natalie on their apparently defenseless flying palace gifted by the Emir of Qatar. He was referring to the new Air Force One plane, as well as to reports that Harp joined Trump and a small group of people when he secretly swapped planes leaving Turkey last month. Here's what you need to know about the Trump assistant, who has been called both a gatekeeper and a comfort blanket. A California native and member of a conservative Christian family, Harp followed an unorthodox path into an already unconventional White House. She rose to fame by crediting Trump with saving her life. In his first term, Trump got the Right to Try Act passed to give some patients greater access to experimental treatments, which Harp used for her bone cancer. She quickly gained prominence and popularity in Trump's MAGA, that is, Make America Great Again, wing of the Republican Party, by talking about the experience, and soon after joined an advisory board for Trump's 2020 re-election campaign. When I failed the chemotherapies that were on the market, no one wanted me in their clinical trials, she said, at the 2020 Republican National Convention. They didn't give me the right to try experimental treatments. Mr. President, you did, and without you, I'd have died waiting for them to be approved. After the event, Trump said, she lit up the television screen like very few people I have ever seen do it. Following Trump's loss in that election, Harp found work hosting a show at the conservative One America News Network, or OAN. There she became known as a ferocious Trump defender and promoter of false claims that he won the 2020 election. She left the network in 2022 to join Trump's next presidential campaign. Most accounts of Trump's views of Harp come via anonymous secondhand sources in books by reporters such as Maggie Haberman, Jonathan Swan, or Michael Wolff, and very little is publicly known about her private life. Trump is like everything that my mum taught us to respect, her brother Preston Harp said during a CNN interview on Tuesday. So I think that's where her infatuation for Trump comes from, honestly. He added that Harp was fixated on the White House from a young age and had written letters to previous presidents, including George W. Bush, during the Iraq War. He told CNN her dream came true finally when she got to the White House, and that his sister was Trump's biggest fan, so that's probably why he likes her. And she's good-looking. She's got a good personality. She thinks that he saved her life. So somebody living with that kind of gratitude must feel pretty good, he said. Harp's official title at the White House is Executive Assistant to the President, which typically denotes a lower-tier position that entails managing logistics, scheduling, communications flow, and mundane but vital secretarial work. By all accounts, though, Harp has given the role new meaning, and her profile is significantly higher than that of her predecessors, such as Madeleine Westerhout in Trump's first administration. When a CNN reporter earlier this week asked Trump about Ossoff's comments, the White House reacted angrily later on its official X account, saying the reporter Kristen Holmes had taken a cheap shot at a staff member. Someday your children will come across your disgusting and inhumane question, another post directed at Holmes read. They will be sickened and embarrassed to have a parent be so callous and vindictive. Harp's presence as a staffer is nearly constant in Trump's second term. Reporters at the White House frequently see her standing just feet away from Trump in the Oval Office or boarding Air Force One for many of his domestic and international trips. She's always around, one source close to the White House told the BBC, literally always. Among White House insiders and members of the press, she is often referred to as the human printer because she's often spotted carrying a portable printer to provide Trump with hard copies of articles and social media posts, which he prefers. In practice, this means that Harp has an outsized ability to control what information or updates Trump receives, according to another source familiar with White House operations. Other anonymous sources have described her to U.S. media outlets as a, quote, gatekeeper and, quote, comfort blanket. Harp also serves as something of a social media scribe for Trump, posting to his Truth Social account on his behalf. In one image, she has been widely shared in the aftermath of Ossoff's comments. Harp is shown typing a post in the president's own writing style, as he dictates to her while watching a speech by Kamala Harris in 2024. Amid the recent focus on Harp, the White House has described her as a trusted and valued member of the team, although Trump has rarely spoken about her on camera. Ossoff was one of many Trump critics who noted Harp was reportedly on the plane that the president boarded to leave Turkey after the U.S. supposedly received information about a threat from Iran. Reporter Haberman, who has also reported extensively on Trump's presidency, was asked during an appearance on the news network MS Now why Trump took Harp with him on a secret plane. "Because she is sort of his binky, for lack of a better way of putting it, a comfort blanket." Haberman and Swan reported for the New York Times in 2024 that Harp had supposedly written in a letter to Trump, "You are all that matters to me." U.S. national debt passes $40 trillion after doubling in a decade. U.S. national debt has more than doubled in a decade to reach a milestone, $40 trillion, Treasury figures show. The rise reflects years of heavy spending under both the Trump and Biden administrations, along with higher interest payments that have steadily added to the total. In 2016, the national debt stood at just under $20 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office has projected overall borrowing would reach $39.6 trillion by the end of fiscal year 2026. The faster-than-expected rise has sharpened concerns about how quickly the government's borrowing needs are growing and what that means for future interest costs. The Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, said the U.S. was nearing its $41.1 trillion debt ceiling, with debt projected to climb to about $64 trillion by 2036. As the federal government spends more to cover its budget deficits, consumers have faced higher interest rates and inflation. The $40.05 trillion as of August 18 covers all outstanding Treasury bonds, bills, and notes, and underscores the scale of U.S. borrowing under two presidents. The interest rate on 30-year bonds, which are a type of debt used to raise funds from investors, hit 5.34% on Tuesday, the highest level in almost 20 years. Those rates, known as yields, influence how much the U.S. government, companies, and consumers pay to borrow, affecting mortgages, car loans, and credit cards. The recent surge in bond yields has been driven by rising oil prices linked to the U.S.-Iran war, with investors worried about inflation. There are also concerns over government debt and the huge amounts of cash being borrowed by tech firms to develop artificial intelligence, with the timeline and level of returns on investment uncertain. While ordinary people are unlikely to be affected immediately, difficulties in managing the debt could eventually trigger disruptions on a scale similar to the 2008 financial crisis, according to economics professor David Jacks. The pace of America's growing debt was accelerating, and at some point the bills will come due, said Jacks from the National University of Singapore. The Treasury Department announced on Wednesday that it would increase its buyback operations by at least double, from $2 billion to $4 billion, from September 9 to November 4. It said the intervention reflected its desire to provide greater liquidity support for longer-term bonds. The rate on borrowing costs over 30 years eased off the back of the move to 5.18%. John Canavan, lead analyst at Oxford Economics, said the decision to increase purchases appeared to be an attempt to provide relief on long-term borrowing costs, which has been under significant pressure from rising oil prices inflation risks, and heavy supply due to global sovereign and corporate borrowing needs. But he said given the size of outstanding Treasury debt, the increase in buybacks from the government was unlikely to provide meaningful long-term relief. René Albrecht, senior analyst at DZ Bank in Germany, said the U.S. government feared the pain of 5% or higher yields over the long term, not just because it raised borrowing costs for the government, but also the private sector. It's only 3 months until the midterm elections, Albrecht said. The Treasury have had to grab into the toolkit in order to get a hand on the recent rise in yields. But economist Mohamed A. L. Erian said that beyond the bond market reaction to push down longer-term borrowing costs, the move by the Trump administration was about the possibility of a broader strategy to keep control of interest rates, known as yield curve control. While the move can help bring down longer-end yields in the immediate and short term, and thereby help lower mortgage and other borrowing costs, it risks collateral damage and unintended consequences, he added in a social media post. The amount the U.S. owes compared to its annual economic output, known as its debt-to-gross domestic product ratio, is 125.8%, according to the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. It is one of the highest among the world's largest economies. In comparison, IMF figures show the UK and China's debt-to-GDP ratios are 103.6% and 106.9%, respectively. Japan has the highest debt burden among the world's major economies, with a debt-to-GDP ratio of more than 200%. The U.S. has longer-term fixed mortgage deals than other countries, such as the U.K. Currently, the average interest rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage is 6.67%, according to finance firm Freddie Mac. While borrowing costs for homeowners have been rising, they remain lower than in 2023, when such deals averaged 7.7%. Minutes released on Wednesday by the Federal Reserve, which sets U.S. interest rates, reveal that concerns over inflation deepened among policymakers at its last meeting. It said there were several participants in favor of increased rates last month. The central bank ended up holding its benchmark interest rate in the current 3.5 to 3.75% range for the fifth time in a row. Many participants also said rate hikes would likely be necessary if inflation did not decline, with some suggesting interest rates were not high enough to see price rises fall back to the Fed's 2% target for inflation. The Fed is expected to hold its policy rate steady again at its September meeting after recent data showed inflation eased slightly and firms unexpectedly shed jobs in July. Ecuador intelligence chief and five Americans killed in Kenya helicopter crash. Ecuador's intelligence chief and his wife have been killed in a helicopter that crashed at Mount Ololokwe in central Kenya. Michelle Sensi Kontugi, 44, and his wife, fashion designer Stephanie Holohan, 42, were among the group of seven people, six tourists and the pilot, killed in Samburu County at approximately 1300 GMT, that is 6:13 GMT on Wednesday. Five of the victims were Americans, a U.S. State Department spokesman said. The Reuters news agency reports that Holohan also held U.S. citizenship. The Kenya Civil Aviation Authority said the helicopter was on a scenic flight from a wildlife conservancy in Loisaba to Esweo Nayo, a river that flows along several national reserves. Samburu County is a popular tourist destination with many private wildlife conservancies and is renowned for its stunning landscape. Images from the scene show smoke at the wooded crash site on the mountain as members of the Kenya Red Cross approach the still-burning wreckage. Ecuador's President Daniel Noboa named Cenci Contugo director of the country's Center of Strategic Intelligence in January 2024. The Office of the President and Ecuador's National Assembly expressed their condolences over his death and that of Holohan. The Italian-Ecuadorian businessman had had close links to Nooba even before he was chosen to lead the intelligence service, and was considered a close ally of the president. Shortly before being named head of the agency, he had served for 4 months as a minister in his cabinet. Noboa has declared 3 days of national mourning, starting on Thursday. Newspapers in Ecuador have also run obituaries of Holohan. The Guayaquil-based designer founded Cenci Studio, a brand praised for incorporating traditional Ecuadorian elements and materials in its designs. Lady Laurie Helicopters, which operated the Eurocopter aircraft, said it was deeply saddened by the accident. Our deepest sympathies are with the guests, crew, their families and loved ones, and all those affected by this tragic accident, a statement read. According to a memo seen by the BBC's U.S. partner, CBS News, one of the Americans killed in the crash was NBC Universal journalist Jose Alberto Suarez. In the memo, NBC Universal called Suarez a deeply respected leader and beloved friend and colleague. Jose was an exceptional colleague and mentor to many, the memo read. Miami restaurateur Roger Duarte was among the Americans killed in the crash, according to local and U.S. media. Commenting on his death on X, U.S. Representative Carlos Antonio Jimenez wrote, "Our prayers are with their loved ones during this incredibly difficult time. May their memories be a blessing." The other victims have not yet been identified. Helicopter crashes are not uncommon in Kenya. In February, a helicopter crash in the Rift Valley county of Nandi killed 6 people, including a member of parliament. In 2024, the military chief, General Francis Omondi Ogola, died after an army helicopter that was carrying 11 people crashed in the west of the country with only 2 survivors. In June 2021, at least 10 soldiers were killed when their helicopter crashed while landing near the capital, Nairobi. Carney asks for end to U.S. alcohol ban, province leader says, as trade deal nears. Prime Minister Mark Carney has asked Canadian provinces to restore U.S. alcohol to the shelves of supermarkets as a trade deal with the U.S. edges closer. Trade negotiators met on Wednesday for the third time in as many days after U.S. President Donald Trump paused a new wave of tariffs he had threatened to impose overnight on a range of Canadian goods. Details on what the agreement includes have not been announced, but the Premier of Nova Scotia said Carney had asked for an end to the boycott of U.S. whiskey and other drinks. Reports suggest the deal may cover Canadian steel, aluminum, and cars, in addition to U.S. alcohol. Trump said the proposed deal would be welcomed by U.S. farmers and manufacturers, while Carney said it will secure the best terms for Canada's strategic sectors and provide certainty on the future of U.S.-Canada trade. Speaking to reporters on Wednesday, after a 45-minute meeting with his Canadian counterpart, U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer said the U.S. was very happy and that the deal eliminated some of the irritants with Canada. "We feel confident that we've reached an agreement that will not only continue to protect American workers, American jobs, American supply chains, but really strengthen the North American economy," Greer said. He said he will soon brief Congress and U.S. stakeholders on the deal's details. Trump said Canada had agreed to eliminate tariffs on U.S. farmers, though he did not specify which specific agricultural sectors would benefit. Asked whether the U.S. will also reduce some tariffs it has placed on Canada, Trump said, "by a little bit." In a post on X on Wednesday, Carney said significant progress had been made and that they were moving toward an agreement that addressed Canada's most important strategic sectors. This has been Jane reading the BBC World News for Thursday, August 20, 2026.